Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with actor Cassandra Small. Cassandra is in Sarasota, starring in a production of The Sty of the Blind Pig, currently playing at the Banyan Theater. Cassandra's story is not your typical how I became an actor story. In fact, it's almost magical. So if you're curious, as I certainly was, hang on, here come this show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about self-awareness. It's about knowing all of who you are. As a therapist, it's glaringly clear to me that most of us are in denial for so much of who we are. We learned so early in life that certain things about us were unacceptable, maybe even caused punishment or abuse or teasing or neglect or some consequence which we absolutely could not bear in our youth. And so we learned to pretend that we were only those things which seemed to bring consequences which we liked. Smiles, pats, kisses, affection, rewards, acknowledgement. You know, this makes perfect sense. This is what human beings are able to do, to be flexible, to change with the environment, with needs. You know the expression, necessity is the mother of invention. Well, we human beings are able to invent when we have necessity. And when a particular quality or a particular way of being brings something unpleasant or dangerous, we have the capacity to find a way not to show that. The problem with that is that, first of all, it doesn't go away. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I talk about the collection of characteristics and qualities which we demonstrate as our cover story. You know, the way a spy has a cover story, that is pretending to be something they are not, so that they are not caught out because it would be dangerous. Of course, it's exactly what happens to us. And undercover, I say, we put all those things which would have gotten us a consequence we couldn't tolerate. The problem, of course, is that those qualities don't go away. We can't amputate a part of ourselves. They go undercover, but they are still there. And it takes energy to suppress parts of yourself. You may not even be aware of how you're doing it, because of course it's being done for you by your unconscious and your brain. Let's say you had a very funny laugh. People teased you, maybe chastised you, said, ugh, that's terrible, don't do that. So you learned not to laugh. You might smile, you might chuckle, you might giggle, but no belly laugh. Which, by the way, is a big shame, because belly laugh is not only so terrifically delightful for the person who's laughing, and it causes endorphins, which is wonderful for our body, but it's also endearing to others. So, okay, so let's say you figured out a way not to do belly laugh. Well, belly laugh still lives in you. So let's say something really hilariously funny happens. Everyone else is belly laughing. Your brain drops a chemical in your bloodstream that says, and immediately, instinctively, reflexively, instantaneously, the impulse to belly laugh is squashed. And maybe you get your giggle or your smile or whatever it is that you figured out how to replace belly laugh with. Well, that little experience, that dynamic of the brain saying no, dropping the chemical, that actually takes energy. It happens so quickly and it's so out of your awareness that you're not aware of it. But it does take energy. In addition, you're cheating yourself from this extraordinarily delightful and life-enhancing experience, the belly laugh. You know I'm using this as an example. It could be anything. And in fact, these things are person-specific, and I have seen people suppress, deny, ignore, pretend not to be lots and lots of things. Anyway, it is better to have access to all that you are. First of all, it frees up that energy that you're not even aware you have. And second, as in the case of the belly laugh, life is enhanced when you can be who you are. Also, we all know that we're hiding something, even if we're not consciously aware of it, and we feel somehow flawed or bad. When you get all of yourself back, there's a tremendous amount of freedom. Okay, so the Lynn Show is about making this point. Is there something you had to hide, deny, pretend was not you? If there is, it is not too late to recover it. And that is what psychotherapy is all about. If you want to talk about psychotherapy, if you want to get a copy of my book, if you want to get me to come and talk to your group or organization, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. There's all kinds of stuff you can get at the website, including podcasts of all of the shows, including this one, and of all of the interviews that I have done, including the one I'm about to air with Cassandra Small. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. We make it so difficult for artists in this culture that in order to do it, it has to be who you really are. This interview with Cassandra Small is remarkable. You will hear when she finally talks about having discovered and embraced her passion as an actor. You will hear that. But what you will hear before and after that is a woman who has many, many interests, many, many callings, and who consistently recognized what was right for her and what was wrong for her, even when it went against the conventional wisdom. You will hear her say how many times she tried to complete college education, but it just wasn't right for her. But of course, the conventional wisdom is she should have, must have, ought to have, right? Well, should have, must have, ought to have doesn't have meaning for Cassandra Small. And it's not that she's stubborn or rebellious. It is that she simply knows herself. And so even in really difficult situations, Cassandra honored Cassandra. And it is what I want you to hear. And so I'm not going to talk anymore. Here, now, Cassandra Small.
So I'm here with Cassandra Small because she is in a production of The Sty of the Blind Pig at the Banyan Theater. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and, as you are clearly an actor. So do you define yourself as an actor? Is that what you
say? I do.
Yeah, okay, good.
I do.
So I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when getting attention, performing, any of that occurred to you, called you, attracted you, interested you?
Probably when I was maybe 4 or so, towards the end of the cleaning day. The kitchen was always the last thing to be cleaned. So after all the dishes were done and surfaces were cleaned, the floor was swept, my dad would put cornmeal on the floor and put music on the hi-fi, which for people who are too young to know, that's a stereo system where you put vinyl records on. He would turn on the hi-fi and we would dance and sing.
On the cornmeal in the kitchen?
Yes, because it would slide on the linoleum.
I know.
And that's how I learned to jitterbug.
Oh my goodness.
But in between songs or when we would break for some juice or water, he would tell stories of being a younger man, wearing his zoot suit, going to hear the big bands play, and naming all of the people that he got to see in concert and so forth. So that...
I'm just curious, do you remember the songs that you would dance to?
Take the A-Train. Caldonia. What make your big head so hard? Mop! So, yeah. But that kind of spurred the times I would be in my room with the hairbrush in front of the mirror, you know, doing that kind of thing. And I enjoyed...
So now, the hairbrush in the mirror, are we talking about...
Singing. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So you started singing. So it was music that started it.
It was music and then watching movies and seeing people in movies. And I always thought, I could do that.
Yes. Okay, so we're talking about 5, 6, 7. We're talking about...
When I was about 2 and a half, my legs were very, very bowed. And my parents kind of felt like I would grow out of it. And then people began to alarm them. Oh, that maybe there's something wrong. She may have rickets. She may have this. She may have that. Friends said, why don't you just have a pediatrician look at her or whatever? So their great idea was, yes, her legs are not growing the way that they should, so we can do surgery and break her legs. And my father was like, that's ridiculous. We're not going to break her legs. Why don't we put her in dance school and see if her using her body in a different way might let her body correct itself? And sure enough, it did. Dancing was more an experience that was satisfying to me than something that I would do in front of someone. But the acting and the singing part, it was as if my dad and I would do our own shows. We'd be sitting at the table, he would start humming something, then I would sing it, or he would sing a phrase and then say, what song is that, kitten? And, you know, that kind of thing back and forth. So it was very interactive for me. Fast forward to, I guess, the age of 7 and a half or 8, my teenage brother, who, like most hormonal guys, had every conceivable plan to get girls. Well, he figured out that there were lots of girls in churches. So he joined a community choir. So it wasn't attached to a particular church. It was a choir that traveled around to different churches.
Smart guy.
And they had some really cute girls in that choir. So I think it was happenstance that my parents were doing something one evening. He was supposed to go to choir rehearsal, so he had to take me. And he saw the reaction it got from the girls, that he was the guy taking care of his baby sister. So now I'm attached to his hip every time. And that was my foray into singing in public, because prior to that, I just always, you know, when you do programs in school, everybody sings together, but as far as singing as an individual in front of people, that was my first...
Well, wait, hold on now. So you go with him. Mm-hmm. Do you sit in the audience and watch, or do you stand up there and sing?
No, they said, baby, come up here and sing with us. Come on up here and sing with us. So I started singing with them. And so I don't know how it happened, but the choir director looked at me and said, we want you to sing this song. So I said, I don't know the song. So they sang it for me a few times, and then I started singing it, and everybody started getting excited about it, and I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. Maybe this wasn't such a bad idea. So I really, for a period of maybe about 5 or 6 months, on the weekends and one night a week, we would be with the choir and go around to different churches and so forth.
So you had a solo.
I had a solo. A solo. One. And it wasn't always performed, because at different churches we performed different numbers. So every then and again, I would get to sing my little solo.
Yeah, but it was enough, apparently.
Yes.
to let you know that, I mean, what I hear is you're saying, oh, well, this is, I'm home here.
Yeah, and it just felt right. It felt good.
Yeah. Okay, so what, so then this is 5 or 6 months, and then what happens?
Well, my brother, I think, graduated high school by then. He went off to the Army. So that kind of fizzled out. Now we get to high school, the age where people want to be in talent shows and so forth. But by this time now, I've kind of, you know, when you get to be a teenager and you figure out all the things that are wrong with you that are not wrong with other people.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so now we're not singing in public in front of people because there are so many people who can sing so much better than me. All the other girls are cuter than me, and they got better shapes and more popular. You know, the thing that all the teenagers
yes.
do. So in terms of performance things, a group came to Chicago's West Side. And they started a program at a place called the Ecumenical Institute, and the whole focus of it was people coming together to promote understanding between other people, so that they put together a show with inner city kids that they would take to the suburbs, to different churches and so forth, so that there was dialogue and for people to get to meet, because quite honestly there were pockets of people in Chicago who had never interacted with a black person. In high school, I was part of the Advanced Mix Choir, because that was a chance to sing.
In a group. Right.
In a group. Okay, so, and ever the oddity, I was the only girl that was in the tenor bass section.
What were you singing?
I sang first and second tenor and first bass.
My goodness.
So I was always singing with the guys. And a group of the guys had a singing group. And this singing group knew a woman named Charlie who worked at the Ecumenical Institute. So when they got ready to produce this show, they invited the guys to do it, who invited me to come meet Charlie. And then, you know, it went on from there. And I must have been 16.
So, okay, so you get into this thing, mm-hmm. and it's there are these performances, right?
Mm-hmm.
And are you now singing part of a group, or are you finally singing alone?
No, it's an ensemble performance
right.
still.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not have a lead in that show, but I just so enjoyed the being on stage, the camaraderie of the group and all of that. Unfortunately, the grant ran out. They didn't get refunded.
Yeah, right.
And so all of that. By this time, I'm now involved with Upward Bound. It was one of the social reform programs that came in the 60s mm-hmm. to work with at-risk inner-city youth and reinforce them in a way that they would be prepared to be successful in college and beyond high school. And I was part of the pilot program. Upward Bound was set up so that during the school year, 5 days a week, there were centers in communities in the inner city where youngsters could come after school. They could get help with homework. There was a library there. You had some level of mentorship. As part of the program, though, during the summer, you went and lived on a college campus like a college student.
Wow.
And the program paid you a stipend that was put into a checking account. They taught you how to use a checking account, budget money, you know, all those kinds of life survival skills. And these were really good schools. Northwestern University had a program. Barra College in Lake Forest was the college that I was at. That process kind of trumped seeking out any other possibilities for performance things. When I came back from my first summer at Barra College, I, again, my singing buddies were talking about doing a show, and somehow or another that went into somebody telling me about South Shore Community Center having a theater there, and just on a fluke after school, I took the L and went over there. I didn't even know what they were auditioning for. I had no idea what an audition was like or whatever. I just showed up and I said to the guy, I think I'm interested in doing this. He had me read something, and he was interested in casting me for a show. So by this time now, my parents are divorced. We have a whole different social dynamic. And I told my mom about this, and she immediately nixed it. She said, no, you will not. When you have a 15-year-old that has the body of a 22-year-old, you're really concerned about your child being someplace Yes. Where you're,
so she could be victimized.
Right.
Right.
So that was kind of like, no, that's not something that you're going to do.
Because your connection to your father was so tight. The divorce, wasn't that really difficult for you?
It was pretty devastating. This was really big because at 14, we have moved from our original part of the West Side. Now we're in a neighborhood that's kind of foreign to me, and it is a block and a half from Stone Temple Baptist Church, which is where Dr. King brought the Southern movement to Chicago, started the Union to End Slums, and I got involved with that as well.
Right.
So,
God, you're all over the place. Really? I mean, you had such, it's ironic, I mean, you had such a rich and diverse childhood.
I did.
My God.
I did.
And in the presence of what I can only imagine was really a kind of devastating loss for you.
I have a belief that everything that happens to you not only is for a reason, it is for a good reason, if you'll claim the good in it. So the point at which these things were going on and there was so much social upheaval going on at that time, and I was a highly emotional teenager, and probably the thing that was most difficult for me was managing these very mature ideas that I had with this underdeveloped personality.
Yes, with this child.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. And because my socialization had everything to do with always being around adults.
Yes.
So I was pretty awkward with people my own age.
Yeah.
So hanging out with movement people worked for me because everybody there was some sort of oddity.
Yeah. Yes, 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 yes.
It was mostly
older than you.
Right, right.
Right.
So it was kind of like the fraternity and sorority of the broken toys or whatever. So, but what happened to me is that I wound up with this personality that was so compartmentalized. There was a behavior for my movement people. There was a behavior at home with my mom. There was a different behavior at school. So the school personality didn't interact with the movement personality, that didn't interact with my family personality.
And then where there was the performer. Who went underground, apparently.
Oh, big time.
Right.
Big time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, I can see that this is the good and the bad news. You know, I mean, that as you say, if you choose to embrace the good of it, there's a hell of a lot of it, even at the same time,
and
it must be a lot of pain.
I was very blessed in my experiences.
So far, we have not gotten to where you were able to wrap your arms around this career. So you're 15, and your mom won't let you be in a show. So then what happened?
We had quite a bit of head bumping, and by the time I turned, just before I turned 16, I made the decision to go and live with my dad, who had then remarried a much younger woman, really sweet lady, but not prepared to have a teenager in the home. So that was not necessarily going well. By the time I was 17, I kind of figured out what I needed to do was, I needed to do me.
Yeah.
Kind of the perfect storm of opportunity. After I left the boarding school, I went back to the public school that I was supposed to be in, and then this whole high school student movement started. We started getting a lot of press. I was at a community meeting, and there was the City Colleges of Chicago were launching a new campus that was to be named Malcolm X Community College. They brought Dr. Charles Hurst in to be the president of it. The new campus hadn't even been built yet. They were being housed in several different locations. But Dr. Hurst approached me after the panel discussion, and he said, I want my college to mentor and develop minds like yours. So he offered me a slot as an incoming freshman in the fall of that year in a special admissions program, and I accepted. So I was going to have financial aid and those kinds of things. And I went to my dad and I said, I think that this is showing me it's time for me to step it up a notch and get out on my own. I want to try to be the boss of me, mm-hmm. and see if I can do that. And so, you know, my dad was very supportive of that and said, you know, and if for whatever reason you feel like you don't want to do that, you can always come back home.
Good guy.
So, yeah. This seemed like such a perfect fit. This is a college that's going to be filled with other people who are social activists. I'll get to be in an environment with people who are like me
in a
learning situation. So I thought that was really great.
You go to school, what are you majoring?
There was a Pan-African group on campus that I really was gravitating towards. And I became a part of that group. And unfortunately, my involvement with that group caused me to stop my education. Because we started breakfast programs and we had after-school tutoring. And as a result of being involved in that group, I met my first husband. Now I'm not in school. We're living together. Now I'm expecting my first baby. So it just, as I'm thinking back on this and what the chronology was, it seemed like there were longer time frames there. But I'm sure that's only because my time on the earth hadn't been that long. So 4 or 5 months seemed like a whole year to me.
Well, I know you're here now, but I can't even.
So let's clip it.
Yeah.
Here's
No, it's okay. I don't mind hearing the story. It's just fascinating because given what you've said so far, I can't even imagine how you got to here.
How I got to here was, now I have 2 children. I'm divorced at 22. My daughter was just turning 3 years old, and her younger sister was not quite a year old. Then 14 months after my divorce, I met the love of my life. We will have been married 40 years. When we got together, our game plan was I was going to go back to school and pursue a degree in midwifery. He wanted to be a doctor, and
Wait a minute. Midwifery, really?
Really?
I mean, where did that come from?
Because I so loved pregnancy,
the baby business,
and the babies, and the whole birthing deal, and all of that. We saw an article in the paper that the United States Army was going to reinitiate their medical training program for doctors. And so we said, well, hey, well, you know, this can work. Once you get in, you'll be able to ace these tests and get into medical. So we just knew this was going to work.
Of course, of course.
Anyway, the long and short of it was he got into basic training. The week after he got out of basic training, they shut the program down in Walter Reed.
Oh, my God.
They closed it completely. We've now had a baby together,
of
so
course.
We have three children, and then he has a son from his first marriage. So we are taking care of 4 children off of E1 pay, which is like no money. But the pertinent point of this was the girls were not adjusting to him being out of the house because when his orders changed, he had to go to Fort Hood. We couldn't afford to move with him because he didn't have enough rank for us to live on base.
Right.
I didn't have any child care for the children. So we were in San Antonio, and this man is hitchhiking home every weekend to see his family. I'm working 2 jobs. I have friends helping me with the kids at night. It was just a crazy time. But the bottom line was, every Sunday when it was time for him to go back, the children fight these temperatures. We're talking 103, 104. We're worried about febrile convulsions and all this kind of thing. And finally, a neurologist was rotating through the clinic when we brought the girls in. He says, you know, I've seen this before. I see it in my wife every 2 weeks when I'm on call. So he referred us to mental hygiene. Therapist saw us and he said, soldier, what I can tell you is this. Your children are not going to survive this separation. You have 2 children here who have been abandoned by a biological father, and you are the center of their universe. This can't go on. He says, you've either got to figure out how to get your family where you are, or you got to get out of the Army.
Yeah, good for this person.
Thank God for this person. So my husband got an honorable discharge under hardship.
Yes.
So with all the craziness, we never got damaged in any way, thank God. But so now we're in San Antonio. I felt it being a very nurturing kind of an environment. I think it's a really romantic little town. It's very family-oriented, I'm sure, because of the strong Hispanic influence there. Now I'm turning 30. I've had another child.
Oh,
after sterilization surgery.
Oh, of course.
That's our
right.
Why? Look, I'm the queen of the long shot.
That's right. Yes, you are.
Oh, that I could be a gambler. So, his name is Gibran. He's now 34 years old.
Yeah. And we're happy to have him.
Yes, absolutely. So, as young marriages will, we were having some really strained times, not just financially, but emotionally, two young people who are really trying to figure out who the hell they are. The advent of the 30th birthday, I don't know where this came from. I just decided I did not want to have this compartmentalized personality anymore. It was too exhausting.
Okay, so now, when you said it the first time, I thought you discovered this sort of in retrospect. Are you saying now that you were always aware that you had these different people?
Yes. I'll tell you what put me in touch with that. In social situations, if I decided I wanted to have a gathering,
right,
it was always such a conflict in my mind. The white friends, the Pan-African friends,
right,
the church friends,
the movement,
the school friends,
right? Right. And could you
put them all together? Right.
Oh my God!
And what would they think of me? Which personality would I show them?
Right. Who would have this party?
Who would host the party?
Right. Exactly. Right.
After five attempts to go back to college and never being able to make it through a single semester, a light bulb went off. You're not interested in doing this. You keep doing this because everybody said you were supposed to do it. I loved learning. I thought it was just utter foolishness that you had to take Comp 101. And I so could see the profit motive in the educational system. That pissed me off. I was beginning to discover that this pursuit of external validation was going to be a very empty endeavor. So at 30, I was like, why do I do this to myself? It doesn't feel good. I have no sense of who I am as a person.
I have a sense of all of the things that people say I should do, and I'm such a good girl that I do them.
And such a people pleaser.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah, and I was...
My God, if you came to that at 30, you're ahead of the game.
Well, I came to that at 30 after having spastic colon, migraine headaches, mysterious rashes. My kids are now spiking temperatures. You see, the children are going to... They're going to carry forward the energy that's put into them. So they could only have an emotional reaction to something that was devastating to them because...
It's coming from you. You know, I really want to make this point in NEON. The extent to which parents can achieve the recognition of who they are.
Authenticity.
Authenticity. Thank you very much. Right. That is the extent to which children will be all right.
Mm-hmm.
When parents are inauthentic, children cannot be all right. Parents can't either, but...
And for parents who feel as though they've missed the window, I can tell you, whenever you get all right, start getting all right.
That's right.
I am so excited about my children as adults now. Now that I kind of let myself out of that emotional jail, and the more I figure out things now, and I talk to them about the stuff that I figure out, we have all these aha moments together. And I will tell you, in my very objective scientific process, I am mother to the most awesome people on the planet. I'm serious. I would love to hang out with these people if they weren't my kids.
Yeah, I want to say that. Absolutely, I agree completely. But I want to say even more, that if you didn't have these conversations with your kids, but you simply did it yourself, it would have power for them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because in a family, you can reach critical mass.
That's right.
And the critical mass can just be one parent who's really strong in it, and it just knocks all the dominoes down.
Yes, I agree entirely. And I really think it's so important to say. Also, children whose parents have not given themselves permission to be who they are can't be who they are.
And parents who cannot see how perfect their children are exactly the way
they
are
are
right now will never be able to support their children into realizing who they are.
I couldn't agree more.
I, in my daily affirmations, I say, I am in awe of the favor you've bestowed on my life with the blessings of my perfect soulmate, my children who are perfect in every way, and my grandchildren who are continuing your legacy of light and love in the world.
Not to mention myself.
We got a whole paragraph on that.
All right, so you're 30 and you have the aha, you have the epitome, right? Mm-hmm. Epitome, that's not right.
Epiphany.
Thank you.
I'm with you, girlfriend. We're right here.
And so what happens?
And so now I am just starting to see what things do I want to do. When I got hired at Southwest Airlines, it just seemed like I had found my spot, because their philosophy about work was like mine. It was respectful. We want you to bring your personality to this job and solve problems. We want to compensate you well. We want you to feel good about what you're doing. I never cared for getting up early in the morning. My husband asked me about a week into my training. He says, what are they giving you out there? He says, you're up every morning before the clock goes off. You leave here going to work 90 minutes before your class starts? Now I'm getting to experience the lifestyle that I wanted my family to have, because when I was the only child at home, my parents did travel, and when we traveled pretty well for working poor.
Right.
My older sister's husband was stationed overseas, so my parents sent me to France for 10 months.
Oh my gosh, right.
Stay with her. So I had all of these expansive travel experiences, and so when I started working for an airline, I can do this for the kids.
Yes, right.
I did get my kids up and out. We went places and did things, albeit on an $8 a day rental car, and we kept the peanuts from the plane. By this time now, I've got two girls in junior high and one who's in high school, and at that time, Jerry curls were big, so this was kind of a costly process hair-wise, and especially when you got three girls, they got a lot of hair. But I had a very dear friend who lived in New Orleans, so once every 5 or 6 weeks, me and the girls would fly to New Orleans. I'd rent a car. We'd get there on the first flight of the day on a Saturday, and my friend Peggy had her salon next door to her mom's restaurant. And so while she was doing one girl's hair, the rest of us would be over at the restaurant eating or whatever, and we'd make a day of it. To their classmates, they were like, oh, look at y'all.
Y'all fly to New Orleans to get your hair.
They just didn't know. I couldn't afford to send them to a salon
locally
in San Antonio.
Right.
I coughed up like $60 between her and her mom. Basically, she was just charging me for the product.
Right.
And her mom cut me a great deal for us to eat all day long. And so we had sister time and we hung out, and they thought that was fabulous.
Wonderful.
It was fabulous.
Right. But you know what it's like? It's a little like you and your father with the cornmeal on the floor.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was. So as I worked at Southwest, and as I began to get a greater sense of myself as an individual person, and it was the canvas that I started recreating myself on. It was a completely new work environment. It was a whole new group of people. I could come in the door and introduce the new authentic Cassandra. I could recreate myself in my own image, finally.
Right.
And so that, a friend of mine who had a business called The House, he heard the recording on my answering machine. He said, I love your voice. Could you do that for my business phone? He said, it sounds so professional. So I made his recording. He happened to be the guy for his religious group that took the recordings to the radio station to be aired. So he goes to the radio station one Wednesday to drop the tape off, and the program director says, you know, man, I'm over a barrel here. He says, I'm working 7 days a week, and I'm management. He says, that's not supposed to be. He said, I got to get somebody to cover two formats, but the one that I really need is the gospel format covered on Sundays.
Oh, gee.
He said, and I really need a woman to do it. And so my friend said, hang on, I want you to listen to this. Mm-hmm. So he played the recording on his business phone. And so the guy's name was Mike Kelly. So Mike says, who is this woman? This is a friend of mine, and whatever you have that needs to be done, she can do it. was like, okay. So Mike Kelly said, have her call me. I called on Thursday. I meet him on Friday. I was on the air Sunday morning. No train. I mean, he took me in the control room. He said, you do this, 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 and this. Here's the cheat sheet. Here's the phone number to the engineer if you run into a problem. He got on a plane and left town. So now my kids are all at Twitter's. Mama's going to be on the radio. Mama's going to be on the radio. Mama's going to be on the radio. So I had the kids. I said, now, I don't expect you to be up when I sign the station on at 6 in the morning, because I was hoping nobody was listening at 6 in the morning, because I didn't know from anything.
So wait a minute. You quit your job?
No. This is on the weekends. I still work at Southwest. I'm telling the kids, I want you to listen. If you get a minute, take some notes. I want you to critique me, whatever, whatever. So I almost lost my mind, but I made it through that first day. I mean, after the first 2 hours, it kind of got okay. I was on the air from 6 in the morning to 12 noon, and for people in radio, that's a long air shift. So I get home, and so the kids run and say, Mama, we kept listening. We never heard you on the radio. There was some white lady on there. Oh, that was me talking. But that foray into radio led to the station being the flagship for a concert. The station personnel were setting up for this concert. A guy is putting his video equipment up. I go up to him and say, I'm Cassandra Small from Cape Radio, and my kids are involved in a lot of activities, and some of them I'd like to capture on video. Do you do private events? He said, oh, yeah, sure. And so I said, well, may I have your business card? He said, well, I don't have any business cards. So I gave him my card. This is on a Friday. So Saturday, I go to the supermarket. I come back. My husband says, that video guy that you were talking to called here, and he wants you to do a show. I said, baby, you got it backwards. No, I was talking to him about recording some of the kids' stuff, you know, their programs and things like that. He says, Sam, the man said he wanted you to do a TV show. I was like, let me call this man back. His name was Al Major. He had a show on cable access, and he wanted me to host the show.
Oh, my God.
So that was my foray into television. Sure. Now, what's crazy, though, is with each of these things, the whole radio thing started because my husband, who loves jazz, listened to the college radio station in San Antonio. Somebody told him that during the school breaks, they trained community people to come in and run the station when the students were away on break. And so I encouraged him to do that. He loved the music. He's got a great speaking voice. And so that's how I was critiquing him on his show and giving him pointers. When Celine gave the tape to the guy for me to get into radio.
You were ready.
And the whole TV thing came up. I was at my friend's house. Oprah Winfrey had just gone national. I said, you know what's crazy is what she's doing is what I always thought I would like to do if I could have a TV show.
Oh my God.
Then a week and a half later, the guy calls me to do this show that was called Down South, and it's about current events or whatever affecting the black community. So that's how I started doing that. Sometime later, I got a job working with the PBS affiliate in San Antonio on KLRN called Art Beat. I did that for a while. Now, right alongside, the program director that hired me is now going to leave and go to a bigger market, better job. So they're having his going away party at a theater near downtown San Antonio. And so I'm off from my job at Southwest that day. I said, well, let me go help them set up for this deal because Mike, you know, he's a good guy. I go there. I'm sitting at the bar. Down at the apron of the stage are all these folks that clearly don't have anything to do with the station. These are all white people sitting down there. I'm like, okay. So I sit down at the bar and start talking to this woman. And she and I just start going at it like we have been friends for like 40 years. We're talking about this, we're talking about kids, we're talking about men, we're talking about shopping, we're talking about everything. And so she says, I says, what is the deal? Where are my folks from the radio station? She says, well, there was a scheduling conflict, and these folks are here, they're auditioning for a play. And she says, you got to go read for the guy. This is gospel truth. I said, read for him. I'm looking at this tall white man standing there with eyeglasses on, and clearly he has papers in front of him, and it appears that he's reading. Why do I need to go read for him? Is he, like, retarded or something? So I look back at her, and I say, she must be playing some kind of joke on me, right? I said, you want me to go read for him? He can't read? She said, no, just go down there and tell him you want to be in the show. I said, what do you mean tell him I want to be in the show? I don't even know what the show is. She says, this you can do, this you can do. Go. She says, listen, I know you can act. I've been talking to you long enough. I know you can act. I said, okay. She said, go down there and tell him you want to read for the show. I said, oh, read for the show. That's what that means. Okay, so I go down there. They give me a script. I do the stuff he tells me to do. Then he whispers some stuff to somebody else. And he says, then we need your information. I gave him my information. He says, okay, well, give us a minute. So I go back and sit back at the bar. And I'm talking to her. Name is Marina Young, my Russian Jewish sister. She says, I know they want you. Can you sing? I said, well, I'm not Whitney Houston or anything. I can carry a tune. She said, I know you can sing. I'm listening to your speaking voice. I know you can sing. So they're going to call you. They asked me to come back down there. They want my availability and this. I don't understand what all this stuff is they're talking about, but I'm kind of going along with the program. So they said, well, we'll be having callbacks in 2 days, so you'll hear something from somebody tomorrow. So I go back to her. I said, what are callbacks? She said, that's when they call you back because they're considering you for a part. I said, okay. So they did call me. I came back. He said, we need you to sing. So when I go down there and see, I don't have anything prepared. They said, well, can you sing Happy Birthday for us? I said, so I sang Happy Birthday. He says, well, can you think of any song that you'd like to sing? I think I sang something from Home because my daughter had been in a pageant and that was the song she sang. So I knew the song.
Right.
And I just sang a few bars of it. And so they're like, so we'd like you to be in the show. The show was Godspell. So that was my first show. From there, I heard about auditions at another theater. And they were doing MAME, which I had only seen the movie and only vaguely remembered it. I hadn't read the script. And so I said, I want to be Vera Charles, so I'm going to go and audition for that. And right. I was started saying this to some of my now theater friends.
Right.
And they were like, oh, you can't do that. They cast according to who donates money to the theater. And I don't know that any of these things were true.
Right.
I'm just repeating what they said to me. And so I was like, well, that sounds like a not so bright idea, but anyway. And so they said, and then somebody finally just piped in and said,
they don't
give black people parts at this theater. I said, well, I didn't ask them to give a black person a part. I said, I want a part. And they haven't seen me do what I can do, and they're going to give me a part in this show.
Unbelievable.
And they did. I was in the ensemble.
Yeah.
But I thought, I'm sure they must have thought, who the hell does she think she is coming in here reading for a lead in this show? It's the second show I've ever done, right? You know, a few months before that, I didn't even know what it meant to read for the director.
Okay, wait. The experience in Godspell.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember it?
Oh, my God, do I? Yes.
Say.
The feeling of connecting with other people to generate an energy that goes out into an audience and actually touches people. It was transforming. It was energizing. It was so nurturing. And when you had those moments where it was all clicking just right, when you had those moments that you kind of came out of your body and asked yourself, who is this person doing this character? When you feel like you are watching the experience happen. It was so orgasmic. And in that moment, I understood why drugs and alcohol are rampant in entertainment. Because you would always want to feel that. You would always want that. I'm very blessed that I understood you're not supposed to have it all the time. You do the work, you work hard, you work effectively, and you get that. It's like food is great. You're not supposed to constantly consume food.
Right. Okay, so how old were you?
I was 35 when I started doing theater.
Right. Have you studied or you just keep doing it?
Hadn't taken any classes. I had gotten an agent, so I did Godspell. I was in the ensemble for MAME. my third show, a young maverick director in San Antonio had just gotten a huge grant, renovated a theater. He launched his season with Evita. It was stellar. I mean, it was unbelievable. His next show was A Raisin in the Sun. I got cast as Mama.
Of course you did.
As a 35-year-old woman.
Jesus.
He had body padding built for me. I lived in that padding for 2.5 weeks.
Oh,
I slept in it. I worked so hard on that show. It gave me a chance to be all those women who had fed me.
Mm-hmm. And
I was scared shitless because even in my inexperience in the theater, I understood that this character had to really work or the show,
right,
it won't work. And that year, I got number one newcomer, best female in a drama. At that time, they didn't have actual awards. It was something that the newspaper critics put together. But in both newspapers, I mean, we aced it. But Jerry lost his shirt on Raisin. He said, but I won't stop. He said, but because I've got to do theater the way it's got to be done. And so he went on to stage Zoo Man and the Sign. I was the wife in that. It was at that point when I did Raisin that I began to do television commercials. Of course, I was doing voiceovers already as a result of being at the radio station. So I'm working these crazy hours, sometimes 16 hours, standing on my head, come home, take a nap, be at the school for the kids program, go work a shift for somebody, then be at the theater at 7, stay in rehearsal till 10:30 or 11 at night, be back at work at 7 in the morning, you know.
You're still working?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, my God.
And working a lot, working overtime, working my days off, working my vacation, working. Because what these people need is still on the front burner. So this is something
these people, meaning your family.
My family.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But I couldn't stop doing this. And it was creating a bit of friction at home because this was no longer the wonderful cloistered relationship we started out with. So my husband was really feeling the loss of all the attention and pampering and all of those things that he had experienced early on in the marriage. And I'm sure in his mind and spirit, it looks like he got rooked somehow.
Right.
You know, this is a great chick to begin with.
Yeah,
now
right.
I got all these kids and she runs her ass off somewhere.
This isn't what I signed up for.
Right, I didn't sign up for this.
Right.
Although we had an agreement that I was going to be primarily in the home, responsible for supporting and doing all that stuff while he got his education, training, whatever it was he needed to launch himself. But once the kids were old enough to go to school, now it's my turn. Well, it was great in theory, but in practice, that didn't really feel good. So there was lots of strife in our relationship, and rightfully so, because you need that strife in order to start correction. And a good relationship is the enemy of a great relationship.
What I was thinking was that unfortunately, when one person in a relationship changes, quite often, the other person cannot find a way to be with that.
Right.
You know?
The beauty of this was, though, that I think we both really believed that we were soulmates. We both really believed that we were the mates that we had been praying for. So there was a sense that there's not going to be anything better than this, because this is the thing.
So we better figure it out.
We got to figure it out.
Right. So clearly you did.
Over some years, yes.
Yep.
Over some years, yes. But that whole process of discovering my ability to undertake something and see it through with excellence and consistency was how I needed to validate myself. Because all along the way, there were things on my tapes like, she never finishes anything. She's always going from one thing to the next. My efforts at my self-discovery were read by the adults around me as, she's flighty, she doesn't know her own mind, she's this, she's that. I always knew I was looking for something. So when I got this, it gave me a sense of peace about myself.
You were you.
Yeah. And I have so much respect for this work because the power in the work that we are capable of doing in performance, most people can't conceive of. I'm part of a travel club that is also a business. And in our trainings, the National Director of Training does what he calls edutainment. And it's the concept that the brain will mark and retain what it gains in an entertaining environment more than it will in pure academia and just giving the information. When you give a person a point of reference inside of themselves that connects to the information that you're sharing, they're really likely to absorb and utilize it.
Yep.
Because it's real for them. Mm-hmm. So I really do see art as being edutainment. And I think that's why I want to always be doing this. And you'll know that this is what you're supposed to do. If you will do it for free, if you'll give up sleep, if you'll work 16 hours, leave a job, and then be up till 1:30 in the morning and be back at work at 5, if you'll do that during Hell Week to have a kick-ass opening for a show, this is what you're supposed to do.
This is a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Cassandra. It's wonderful.
Ah, the teary-deary girl. I'm really probably way too hormonal.
I don't think this is hormones. I think this is just who you are. You're just really deeply in touch with yourself. You don't have barriers between what you feel and what you demonstrate.
Yeah. Sometimes that's not necessarily a good thing.
I think it's always a good thing.
I think sometimes
not everybody can tolerate it.
Right.
But that's
true.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
But we'll let that be their problem.
Yeah. Definitely. Thank you so much, Cassandra.
Imagine. We'll let that be their problem. It could be the theme of the Lynn Show. It's their problem if they don't like who I am. My problem is loving who I am, all of who I am. And as you can hear in Cassandra's interview, her continual search, not giving up, not surrendering, even when things didn't seem to work out, even when they were difficult, even when others defined her in ways that were unattractive and not accurate, she continued to look for, search for, and when she found it, embrace Cassandra in every possible way. So, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that inspired you, that intrigued you, something that you didn't know, something that surprised you, something that you knew but needed to be reminded of, something that will bring you back. Because, as always, I will be back next week, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.